and welcome to the African Climate Conversation. I'm Lindsay Taff. I'm Director of Communications at British International Investment, and I'm your host on today's podcast. The African Climate Conversation is a platform that brings together leading African voices to explore, evaluate, and debate the greatest challenge facing the continent. So today we'll be exploring the ways that climate change has a disproportionate impact on women and girls, from peace and security to education, health, social dynamics, and livelihoods. And we'll discuss the importance of ensuring that women are represented at the very highest levels in climate-related policy making and capital allocation, as well as playing a leadership role in designing solutions, for example, through their intimate knowledge of land and sustainable farming practices. So I am delighted to be joined today by three incredible women who have a wealth of insight on each of these topics. First is Evelyn Batamelitsa, who is a Rwandan gender and poverty advisor at UNDP, where she's supporting the development of new governance models for climate financing frameworks and is working to increase women's access to climate finance. We also have Musonda Kapena, who is a Zambian conservationist and nature-based solutions advocate. She's working with women at the community level to empower them as custodians of indigenous knowledge. She's passionate about showcasing how sustainable harvesting of non-timber forest products, such as foods, medicines, and cosmetics, are contributing to the ecosystem and biodiversity conservation in Zambia. And finally, we also have Liberatha Kowamala, who is an environmental conservationist and the founder of Lieb Green Innovations, a conservation organisation that's seeking to develop sustainable solutions to tackle plastic pollution that escapes to the ocean. Her organisation is founded in Tanzania and works with the local youth and women to provide employment opportunities through collecting plastic waste, processing and upcycling plastics into valuable products. Welcome to the show, each of you. Lovely to have you on. So I'm going to kick off the discussion amongst you, and I'd like us to start on the topic of impact. So research and data shows that women and girls are disproportionately affected by climate change. Evelyn, can you start us off? Why does this happen and how does it play out in women's lives?
It's not a secret anymore that women and children are seriously impacted. And this is, we can even cite few statistics on that. For example, when you look at the tsunami of 2004, that you look at the victims where you have at least 70% of those that were affected by tsunami in 2004 being women and children, right up to looking at the floods that made many people displaced in Pakistan in 2010. Again, you're looking at 70% of them being women. You know, globally now, you know, they look at, when you look at the statistics and you look at the reports from the UN agencies, they talk about 80% of people being displaced being women. Again, these are not the numbers. We're talking about the lives. We're talking about the livelihoods of both men and women being impacted by all these natural disasters. So clearly, so these are the statistics. These are the numbers that really makes it very accentuated that the impact of climate disasters are actually really impacting more women. And also let's talk a little bit about the sectors that are most impacted by climate change. And these are the majorities where you found also women. For example, the agriculture sector. We know that globally, 43% of the global agriculture workforce is made by women. More specifically in Africa, we're talking about 60 to 80% of women in the agriculture sector being there. And this, the agriculture sector is absolutely impacted, whether you look at the droughts, when the droughts happen, when you look at the floods, when you look at all these heat waves. So it becomes an interesting conversation now to have. So when we see all of these statistics and when we see the magnitude of the impact of climate disasters on women and children, yet we're not seeing them being on the table to shape and inform the discussion about how we can adapt, how we can mitigate, then it becomes interesting conversation on that. I want also to really put emphasis on the fact that these impacts are not because women are weak or are not able to cope. These are happening against the pre-existing structural gender inequalities that exist in our communities, in our societies, that actually make women much more susceptible to all of this impacted by the climate change.
I mean, some of the figures that you provided there really I mean, surprised me even as a woman, you know, I think farming is such a male dominated sector. To think that it's 60 to 80% of the workforce in Africa and 43% globally is astonishing. And you're right that behind every number, there is a story. And I'd like to bring Masonda in here because you've got direct experience of how these sorts of impacts are playing out in villages around the country in Zambia. Can I invite you to come in, Masonda?
On the ground, and when I say on the ground, this means at village level, you find that culturally, Zambians are very male dominated in the sense that we respect the men in everything we do. At the village level, it's very, very prominent. In the area of agriculture, you find that the men are the ones that decide the land that will be farmed, the size of the land that will be farmed. And remember that when we talk about the land for farming, this is extracted from the forested area. So forest areas are very, very prime areas to clear out the trees and create a farm because the soils are more fertile, the textures are still very nice and soft for root penetration and all. But then it's amazing that the larger crop, in for the case of Zambia, maize is determined by the men. Then the smaller crops like groundnuts and sweet potatoes and beans are what the women are asked to do, primarily because that will be the relish for the household for the 12 months between seasons. The larger crops like the maize and the cotton and the sunflower and so on are the ones that the men would ensure are sold. And then the money derived from that is decided by the men on what it will be used for. Ironically, off season, the men are the ones that then enter the forest to cut down and unsustainably harvest charcoal and high value timbers. The women off season are the ones that go in search of mushroom and wild fruits and wild vegetables and edible oils and termites and caterpillars and so on, which again are considered relish at the household level and really at a very low rate as cash transaction items. So in essence, you find that it is still a male dominated aspect, even for the widows. They may have to rely on their uncles or their brothers, in some cases, their sons, to make such large decisions on how much land will be farmed, how much forests will be cleared, and so on. Those that are married, it's automatic. They fall under whatever the husband says should be done at that particular household, then collectively at that village as well.
And do you find that they have any impact in shaping what those, they might not be the final decision maker, but are you finding any change in how they're able to influence those decisions?
The women are starting to influence the decisions because in some cases, the women have a little bit higher education than the men. So when materials come from agro dealers or from seed providers, the women often read for the men. And sometimes in translating that, they put in their own opinion, which in most cases is beneficial for her as a woman, but most of all for the children and the grandchildren at that particular village. So there is a slow influence, though culturally, looking at our own indigenous knowledge systems, the women were respected as the custodians of the forest in the sense that they would know what kind of insects are coming out and what indicators they would have. In Lozi-land in Western Province, there's a beetle that climbs up and down the reeds of the Zambezi. If they're high up on the reed, it means that the floods are coming and everybody starts to prepare, kind of like an early warning system where they would know this year we need to be on the plateau area and not so much on the waterfront area. So that would then be shared out in the village. If it's riding low on the reed, it means that there'll be no rains, then they would have to start deciding on what kind of crops to grow that would be resilient to a dry, rainy season, so to say.
And this is really brings down the conversation to where it matters, as I was saying. When we're talking about the impact of these disasters, and it's not just about, you know, as I said, the pre-existing structural gender inequalities, exactly what you're mentioning about the cultural norms that have existed for many years that we need to look into. And this is why the conversation about the resilience, the adaptation needs to be context-based. It cannot be decided at the global as a global good, because it's exactly what you, that nuances, that understanding that this is what happens in that particular society of Zambia, that you're able to really come up with the activities or interventions that reflect that context in terms of making sure that women are able to play a prominent role in adapting and building resilience of that community.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like, it's some levels, we need to get hyper-local on how we think about bringing in the right voices at the right point. We're hearing that gender and climate change are inextricably linked across this sort of diverse range of areas. And we've heard a little bit about from Masandra on how women are influencing at the local level. You just mentioned that there needs to be a lot more listening done. How are you seeing that happening at a policy level?
At the policy level, there have been some efforts to ensure that gender issues actually brought into the conversation of climate change. And I have to admit, at the beginning, it wasn't like this. You know, when you look at the discussions about, we are down to the COP27, right? But I think the gender issues when it comes to the COPs started even happening, I think, when we're at the COP 14 or 15 or 16, like that, if my mind sets me correctly. So meaning that these conversations around gender and climate change are not naturally, or at least have not naturally been kind of addressed in a way that is holistic. At the beginning, we're talking about climate change, but eventually we say, oh, no, hang on a second, we need to think about climate change. So it has been an added on. And you can see that that is still the problem, even now, especially when you look at the financing, how the architecture also of the climate change financing it has been set up. Again, the gender issues, they are now more and more because of a lot of advocacy, a lot of noises being made that, we can't talk about this thing without looking at the gender issues that is most important. But again, in terms of really actual and tangible interventions, we are still far away from making sure that climate change and gender issues are addressed in a way that is really meaningful.
All of you on this call today have your own journey into leadership around climate change. How has this affected you personally and in your own work in terms of fighting to be heard around the leadership table?
It hasn't been an easy journey. And I'm not only talking about climate change, which is even much more scientific field, but even when we talk about women's participation in political space, in elections, in peace building even, which is, I was recently in Chad, where with the Hello Gang and trying to make sense of what is happening. But it's very difficult to even make a sense that, if we're talking about 52% of women, 52% of the population of the country, and you're trying to resolve the issues, but you're trying to ignore 52% of the population. Yeah. So it's never an easy thing when you talk about women's participation across the board, let alone in these, contentious issues of climate change. So it hasn't been an easy thing, but the good thing, more and more now, at least, you have many voices. You have men who are also championing it, which is also another interesting development that we're seeing. You've had he for she initiative. So at least more men also are coming on board and really understanding that these are not the issues that are relegated to women, but these are the issues are facing all of us as a community, as a society. So we all have to play a part in it. Liberata, we would love to hear your perspective on this because you're on the ground and you also are working on these issues. We would like to hear your views on these issues.
Actually, I'm on the ground and I've been working since 2018 in this sector. It's on the environmental sector. And I've been working very hard to empower women on how they can actually know what they really need. As I'm working with mostly of women in West Africa, what they're making is just they're looking for just money for their lives, to keep their children, to keep their homes. So they keep on walking around to search for different products. Then they come to sell it to our collection centers. And so it has been our responsibility to sit with them. And as Evelyn has said, it's very difficult to make change on the ground if you are alone. And that's why we also men are being involved in. So it's time for partnership. It's time to come together like women. Actually, as a young person being involved in women empowerment programs, we see that many women are feeling. They are so feeling that how they can be involved in some of the decision making. And sometimes they give ahead positions to other men or boys to take over or to lead it themselves. So for example, we make groups on women on how we can empower themselves, they can lead it themselves to make a difference in the community or in their households, in their homes. So it has been very, very difficult. They fear their men that they were not agree on them that this is going to do this. And it was a responsibility now to make sure that also men are being involved in, because if you talk about women only, it will be just only women.
Liberata, I was going to ask about young people. You work in particular with young people. Are you finding that it's easier to engage with both women and boys of a younger age on the issue of impact of climate change? Do they have a different mindset?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We are engaging both of them. We are not only working with the girls only, but working also with the boys, because to make difference, you must also differentiate. Like it's all the community. The community does not consist only girls. There is also boys. So we needed to involve also boys to have their to teach them on how they can change their mindset and have the vision how they can tackle the climate change issue, because the climate change issue is happening all over the world. It's happening in different areas. It's happening even it's affecting also our lives. And sometimes, because if you are walking around, you see different products around, you see how floods is happening, you see how the sunshine sometimes it's here. As the youth, we are fighting for our lives, so it's affecting also our lives as well. So it's engaging youth and the girls also is a big advantage for us. Like as an organization, we are working with them very, very closely to make sure that they understand the importance to fight change, as well as to make sure that they're making also difference on how they can make different opportunities out of it, because I'm not to be talking about the problems, so we can turn the problems or the challenges into opportunities, like us, how we are making different products out of plastics. So it's one of the one way or another on how we can make differences in our community.
And one of the things that I was quite curious about, whenever I think of climate change, I think of it as an issue that young people are particularly interested in. But I was really taken by Sonda's point that actually some of the solutions we might be looking for does involve us looking at previous generations, where women are those custodians of the knowledge of how things previously were done around things like nature and sustainable resource management. How are you finding that, Liberata?
Actually, it's not. Most of them are learning from the current situation. They're not learning from the previous. So it's very hard for them to adapt on how the future generation will be. So it's time that the generation that is now, we need to make sure that we have a responsibility to teach the younger generation that is coming to adapt on the responsibilities that we are doing to our community. It has been very hard for the some of the youth to adapt to the current situation what is really happening in the world.
And how are you going about that in terms of really tapping into that local knowledge and to the indigenous knowledge that the women have to develop those solutions? How does that work in practice?
Yeah, actually, what we are doing is not about just to make just an impact. It's about empowering them to know, to understand, change their mindset, because they need to understand the leadership that is happening, the climate change is happening, and to come out with a different solution, to come out with a different innovations, to come out with a different inventions. So it's time for them to make sure that they sit down and have their own, to teach them on how they can think tank, to promote, to understand, speak out their voices, to speak about the issue that is happening on their society. I cannot speak to all of them, but they can see by their own eyes that the issue is happening. And to come out with innovation, it's now for them to sit down and to teach them on how they can look on those solutions in their community and to empower the community that they are living in. I would recommend to ask Mosonda, And the issue that is really happening, how is it happening? How is the solution that solving the solution that are being available in our local area?
As you were speaking, I was actually reflecting on the differences between the urban solutions and the rural solutions. In my case, we're looking more at the rural solutions where people still sit around and talk with their grandfathers, if they are still alive, or the elders of the village, especially in the area of harvesting non-timber forest product. In speaking about non-timber forest products, you find that the women in the past had information passed down from generation to generation through oral tradition and practice. So in some cases, you find that to harvest mushrooms, you need to know exactly what type of mushrooms are there and if that particular type of mushroom will emerge that year or not. So you find that a lot of the old women would carry along the younger ones, especially those that are recently married or the ones that are of marriageable age, as a way of preparing them for their own home, where they then would have to be the head of the kitchen. To be head of the kitchen meant they needed to know what's in the pantry, what wild vegetables are preserved for the off season, meaning away from the rainy season, how will they survive? With most wild vegetables and fruits, you find that there's a lot of them when it's raining. And in Zambia, it rains 4 to 5 months of the year. Then after that, there's nothing. So they have traditional ways of preserving certain vegetables and fruits through drying them in the shade or drying them in the sun. For the green ones, they would dry them in the shade so that they maintain their efficacy and vitamin content and all. How they knew what to dry in the shade and what to dry in the sun is through indigenous knowledge systems. So you find that for some things like what we commonly call monkey bread or msekese in my language, it's a pod that is rich in carbohydrates and proteins and fiber. They would pound it and keep it as a pounded cereal or pounded wild fruit. And that would help with feeding the babies from 6 months all the way up to old people, because then it maintains the vitamin content they would need in their bodies. So there's a whole range of things that without the old person being present in the village, the younger ones would not know the value of it. As such, with medicines, it's the same thing. They know exactly what works for flu, what works for malaria, what works with women's reproductive health, what works against prostate inflammation. There's a whole knowledge that we have to tap into so that we transition from just gathering it as a hobby or an interest, but to now start to monetize it. Once we start doing that, a few men in some areas, like in Southern Province, they now support the women because they've seen that there's more money in selling a kg of msekese than there is in selling 50 kg bag of charcoal. So because we don't have the forest close to the village anymore, the men are the ones that walk the further mile and the further mile to find the masuku and the msekese and the mushrooms and bring back to the village where the women then grade it and process it and then dry it and preserve it for the next season or for sale in urban areas. So I think there's a huge difference on where the knowledge is coming from in the urban areas and where it's coming from in the rural areas. But both areas are affected by climate change differently.
Yeah, it's interesting that, I mean, what you're describing, I think what a lot of people have been talking about around climate change is adapting by living in a slightly more in tune way with nature. And it's really interesting to see how that sort of indigenous knowledge and that sort of quite ancient knowledge that's been passed down is sort of becoming more popular again. Evelyn, when we talk about adaptation normally and adapting to climate change, we're thinking about large scale interventions across different communities. How are you finding that adaptation is measuring up against financing and interventions for adaptation and measuring up against, for example, mitigation finance?
The measure is not equal. We've been talking about, at least in the last COP, 21 COP, that we really need to do a lot more to ensure that the adaptation financing is at equal level as the mitigation. Because as we talk now, we're talking about 25% of what we call climate financing flows for adaptation, whereas, of course, the rest 75 is mitigation. So if we can strike at least a deal of having 50-50 financing allocated towards adaptation and mitigation, then that's the best way forward. But here, I think what the challenging has been, even with that 25% that is allocated for developing countries, is that it's not necessarily trickling down to where it matters, again, to the local levels, to the communities. Last year, when we were doing all of this analysis, you realize that only 10% of the climate financing flows goes to the communities, goes to the local communities. And out of that 10%, we have only 1% that goes to women. And this, again, it goes back to how our structures, the mechanisms for dispersing these finances in the way they are designed are not necessarily gender sensitive, or the gender issues comes in as an add-on. Yes, we acknowledge that we are making progress. There have been a lot of changes that has been happening across the four or five financing mechanisms of the climate change, whether we talk about GCF or GEF. But again, we're not yet there. We're not yet there, especially when you look at exactly what Musonda was saying, the knowledge that is there to the indigenous, the way they know how they can build their resilience. But the fact that we are at the policy levels, at the financial levels, we're not able to move with them and be able to really support their resilience is a problem going forward. And I hope this is one of the things that probably are going to be clarified in the next COPs, especially the one of 27 COPs, which is going to focus, I think, preeminently on adaptation issues. Hopefully this conversation can be brought down to where it matters.
There's something there, isn't there, about, you know, getting the finance into the right places. And Musonda, you've encountered this in terms of funders not really understanding local dynamics or how money actually makes its way through to the people who need it most. Can you share on some thoughts on that?
On the aspect of finance, I think what we've experienced at cloud level is that the intention is good, but the context is a little bit off, in the sense that when money is budgeted for the grassroots implementation, most times the people are not properly consulted. I'm saying this because the project officers managing the financing will only go into a village to tell the people what the project is about, how it will be done in their area, and what the indicators are, and what the expected outcomes will be. But the important question is the activity going to be done in that area already accepted? Is it from the people themselves? For example, we talk about we need to put an end to charcoal, but the real question is, who started the charcoal story? Was it started as domestic use aspect? Was it started as a commercial aspect? If the men stop making charcoal, how will the household survive? Do we have alternatives which are indigenous to the area? What is that area good at? We know that each village is set up in an ecological ecosystem that is unique to itself. So in some areas like Northwestern Province, they have a wetland where they produce salt. It's a potash salt. It has so much more potassium than it has sodium. And as such, it's used by traditional herbal practitioners for all kinds of problems, from babies to old people. So if the people were asked what they want to do if they had access to money, they would automatically say, we have salt, but we don't know where to take it. Other times it would have to take the cloud people to say, you have this salt, what have you been using it for all this time? What opportunities do you have? I know for sure that in the urban areas, you can't find that salt. If you do find it, it's 10 to 20 times more expensive than you would find it in that particular ecosystem. So my message is, through Ubuntu, which means I am because you are, because we are, we need to repackage consultation. When I'm consulting Lindsay, I should be able to say, do you have money for salt? Can we start adding value to the salt? Because the women already know how to evaporate it, how to package it. It's never packaged in plastic. It's always packaged in leaves of a specific tree. And they do that because they have known through the years that that leaf will keep the salt efficacy at its highest point. So it's about adding value to the indigenous knowledge systems in specific ecosystems. Mm-hmm. That then you spend less money training the people on how to do something that is alien to them, but instead spend money on bringing out what they already know that now has value in the urban areas and the global market as well. I think that's the story of shea butter in West Africa. So each country on the continent has something that they already have been doing for aeons, and all they need is the catalyst of finances and management and sustainable harvesting practices for them to then enter that commodity onto the global market through better branding, better packaging, better recipes, what do you call it, product development aspect. Then Sekese can make pancakes, it can make cakes, it can make scones and cupcakes, but nobody's doing it because there's no money to promote that on the market, despite the fact that children in the urban areas where they eat monkey bread are healthier than the children in urban areas that do not eat it.
When we were talking a little earlier, Masonda, as well, you were talking about the sort of power structures that make it sometimes hard to get women involved in the decision making of where money goes to. Can you expand a little on that? Because I think sometimes that's not really thought about to a full extent when we're thinking about trying to get money to women's organizations.
Okay, so that is the gender lens versus the cultural lens. So in the village, the men are the decision makers on financial issues, on strategic planning issues, despite the fact that the women are the ones that are often the brains behind it. What I'm trying to say is that a lot of times cloud level funding would come into a village and the men have control. But sometimes the project design would be that the women would have to form women's groups and manage it themselves, but nobody would often volunteer to be the head of that group because they know that in the group they may be the head, but once they go home, their husbands will be very upset that they took on a certain role and that their, you know, gender issues come in, then gender-based violence issues come in. What we've done and learned is to allow a community itself to use its own cultural structures to create groups while at the same time using the traditional aspect of women are custodians. Women know how to speak to their men about certain things. Mm. But if it comes from the project team, then a fight would break out in the household, which then escalates to the village because every woman that's a part of that women's group will not have peace in the household because their husbands expect us to consult them first and ask for permission for their wives to be a part of the leadership structures of the women's groups that we are working with.
Hmm. So it's about taking a more practical approach where it's not too difficult, it's just approaching it in the right way so that everybody who needs to be consulted on the matters that affect them are consulted effectively.
Precisely. In one case, actually in Kalomo, we have perfected it so well by just facilitating the process, and the men feel happy to be the ones to show that they are the ones collecting the msekese and they are the ones bringing it to the village, because then it shows that their macho and the brawn is being put in it. But the women are the ones who in the morning would say, we saw these particular fruits are ripe in the eastern area. So if I were you, I would tell the other men that you had in the east, and they would surely then come back with a nice harvest at the end of the day. So we're not saying the women should be aggressive about it and say, it's my right to do this, it's my right to do that. But they have their own cultural subtle ways which have worked for them for a very long time. So bringing in their aspect uniquely to that particular area, because each area is different. So it's important to be cognizant of that particular area's indigenous knowledge systems and then work with that to build on project models and approaches that would then work holistically for the whole microclimate and eventually for the whole climate aspect in terms of mitigation of certain things or adaptation of certain things, which for them means going back 5 steps to learn about the past and then use what worked in the past and model it with scientific understanding into a nature-based solution for the future.
I just wanted to emphasize a little bit about what Kapena was talking about really being considerate of the context of the cultural norms of the particular community or society that we work with. And I wanted to highlight at least one of the really innovative ways that we can really make this happen when it comes to the climate change financing. When you look at what the African Development Bank is doing on adaptation benefit mechanism, I'm sorry we don't have much time to talk about it, but I really wanted to bring this down to the level of where it's understood. This is an innovative results-based payment mechanism, which is being put to mobilize public and private sector financing. And why is so important? It's because this is meant to build resilience of vulnerable communities and ecosystems. Again, trying to shy away from what other approaches, like what Musonda was talking about, when people come to the field to consult or they don't consult the right people, or sometimes they hear the views of only one segment of the society, the men and not the women. This initiative, this innovative approach is actually bottom-up, meaning that you could be an individual, you can be a community leader, you can be a local leader, you can be a national leader. But what it is that if you're able to define clearly what is the activity you want to do on adaptation, and you can be able to go through this process where then you can be, you can choose whatever activity based on your context, based on your understanding of the cultural norms. And once you're able to determine that activity, we can take you through that process of, you know, looking at the methodologies that we have, the tools. And all we want to do at the end of the day is to have this, what we call certified adaptation benefits, which really can show exactly what that particular activities is supporting the environment, the social meaning, of course, the gender issues as well, but also economic impact of this community. So this is one of the innovative approach when it comes to the results-based payment mechanism that can be used in this particular, in addressing these issues that Kapena and also Liberata were talking about here. So please check out the website of the ABM. It's still at the piloting phase, but it has potential to bring the finances where it matters and try to, you know, as I said, to cite statistics that 10% of the finance going to the local community and 1% going to women, this can be a game changer going forward if it's taken forward. So,
and Liberata, can I bring you here on this? Because I think you've got some great examples of when women are brought in appropriately, they do innovate.
Yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of women, actually, not only women. I could talk about young people that are working very, very, very hard to tackle the issue, and they're trying very hard to do a lot of advocacy, and they are very, very committed on this. And one of the examples that is inspiring me is Elizabeth Watutini in Nairobi. She's young. She's not that very young, but she's trying hard to inspire a lot of young people to advocate on climate change, and she has come with a lot of solutions and level at the local level and how the issue can be tackled.
Wonderful. Look, thank you all for sharing your stories and your thoughts today. I think what really struck me is that actually the quality and the quantity of climate innovation and action that's happening and is being led by women is far greater than we often hear about and that they get the credit for. Actually, now that I have you three women leaders on climate change with me now, can I ask you each to close by sharing what you hope will be the one thing that comes out of COP this November? If I can start with you, Evelyn.
Let me say this, and I would want to actually borrow from the words of the Prime Minister Motri last year when she was in COP, where she said, we need ambitions, we need also the faces. And for me, to tell the truth, when I talk about the ambitions that I want to see at the COP27, it's the ambitions to be able to make sure that we have at least 50% of our financial flows being allocated toward adaptation actions. 50 adaptation, 50 mitigation, because yes, we need both hands, we need both solutions to move forward in addressing the climate crisis that we are in. The second thing, so when we talk about the needed faces, for me, the needed faces, yes, we can talk about the big players, the G7, the G20, the whatever. But for me, the needed faces, the people that are most affected with these calamities, the people that are mostly bearing all this price, high price, and let's face it, for the things that they have not done, you know, look at this, who are paying most is the people that have not caused all this global warming or contributing minimum to the greenhouse gases emissions. So let's put those people on the table. You know, it's sad when you see, okay, yeah, we're talking about the 27, you know, we are the 27 COP. We only have 35% of women, even when 25% of women participate in discussions like this. And when they are there as observers. They are not even given a chance to talk, to express their needs and their concerns. So the right faces for the right discussions is those that are being actually impacted. And who, of course, the majority are who? Women. Again, the conversation is who is impacted, who is making a decision, and who is benefiting. And once we can have the answers to that, then yes, we are able to move forward in a way that makes sense in building resilience and in responding to climate crisis that we're facing.
Wonderful. Thank you, Evelyn. Masonda, can I come to you with your final wish for COP27?
My final wish for the COP27, especially that it's being held on the motherland, on the continent of Africa, is that the African voice needs to be heard. And the African voice ancestrally has been hinged on indigenous knowledge systems, which have an ethos of preservation, of conservation, of leaving some for the next person, of leaving some of these forest resources, natural resources for the next generation as well. We would not be enjoying the forests that we have, the water that we have, the fresh air, the people, or anything if our ancestors did not think of us first. What we're suffering from now is consumerism, it's extraction. But Ubuntu says, I am because you are, because we are. And we are led by women. Women are strategists. Women always take care of everybody. They take care of the children, of the husband, of the grandchildren, which is why they focus on harvesting the forest resources sustainably. When that is done, we will be not only adapting to climate change, but we'll also be mitigating the effects of climate change by letting the women's voices be heard. Ask them nicely and you'll unearth a wealth of knowledge that can work perfectly as nature-based solutions. Thank you very much.
That's wonderful. Thank you. And Liberatha, if we can come to you too.
My wish for the COP27, I wish for the climate to be more talked about, to be the key issues to be addressed, and especially to see that more funds is flowing, let's say like 50% or 30% of it is flowing into the innovations and inventions for the youth. Youth are doing a great work for the Africa and for the world and for the environment, and they are coming with different ideas, which are really, really brilliant. So you'd like to see they are being sustainable to their community, to see that that funds is being able to help these youth to become more active in their communities.
Fantastic, thank you. Can I thank you all for your contribution? It's been absolutely insightful and fascinating, and I really appreciate you all taking the time to do that.